We've been spending quite a lot of time being invited and encouraged here on the retreat to pay attention to our body, to turn towards the experience that we call body. And I'd like to reflect this evening on really the wisdom that our body offers us, the opportunity for learning, for insight. In noticing that we have a body and turning our attention to this body, we are invited to notice that it's right here, that it's here and now, as we say. This body is happening like this. And giving attention to it, we come into contact with this sense of presence or this possibility of an immediacy of awareness that's grounded right where we are, that isn't so distant or disconnected from what's actually happening. And this body is described and spoken of considerably in the teachings of the Buddha. He refers to the body as the first foundation of mindfulness, as the primary and initial place in which we are encouraged to orient our sense of attention, of presence, of focus, of connection. And together with this, the first foundation of mindfulness, there is the second, third, and fourth, which I won't speak of in any detail at this moment, but just to name, the second is, as Leela was speaking about this morning, the second foundation is that area of experience where we notice things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And just being able to recognize that dimension of experience is the second foundation. The third is knowing the states of mind and the condition of our consciousness, or our heart mind, we could say, and what that's like, how that is. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness is being in touch with, being aware of the different things that are arising in consciousness, the thoughts, the impressions, the images, the, in a way, the content of our inner experience. And between this, or these four foundations of mindfulness, we really include the whole, the fullness of our human experience. And in this, we're invited to not observe our experience, and in this case particularly our body as the first foundation of mindfulness, or the first frame of reference to which we can connect with awareness and sensitivity, not to relate to this kind of from a distance, like looking at it, observing it from afar, which is what happens when we tend to just describe in language our experience and not allow ourselves to really feel it. When we say, oh, it's like this, there's something very different about feeling the experience of softness or of warmth or of tenderness. Actually experiencing it in our body is very different than the conceiving, the idea that that might refer to. And so when we come into contact more directly with our body, when we're again and again making this intimate and sensitive contact with it, we start to recognize more and more of what it has to teach us, what it has to show us. And one of the fundamental elements of this body that we start to encounter, we maybe begin to notice or see more clearly, is that this body is in a process that the Buddha spoke of again and again. And this process is a process of having been born, having come into existence, being born. And having been born, there's a process of growing and aging, which includes in it a, although maybe for a little while it seems to be going pretty well, that kind of growing and aging thing, you know, 20, 30 years maybe, if we're fortunate. It might feel like it's all going really well. And then after that we start to notice that it's not going quite as well. And this is what the Buddha talked about as aging. And he talked about aging, sickness, and ultimately death. That this body, having been born, will come to that end. And I was recently reading a dense book on the teachings of a particular monk from Sri Lanka, where he gave a different word. He said, rather than talking about birth, aging, sickness and death, he said, sickness isn't quite the right, didn't quite get the meaning of, because obviously the Buddha didn't use any of those words. He spoke in a different language, Pali. Well, that's the language his teaching is recorded in. He said, and this monk, he said, actually, I think decay is a much better word than sickness to translate. So birth, aging, decay, and death. You think, yeah. It's sort of not like something we feel necessarily that enthusiastic about. We can sometimes struggle with it. We can sometimes resist the fact that this is the nature of, this is the journey of the body. And that all of us, having bodies, are subject to this journey through our lives. And it's often the case that we might become aware, certainly before we come to meditation or retreat, but if not when we're here, if not before, then certainly in this context we start to notice how quickly we get into a relationship of fear in relationship to this body. This body that it doesn't necessarily comfortably age and decay. You know, sometimes it's quite uncomfortable, this process. And times the body is actually something we find really challenging to experience. Not always, of course. But there's a way in which a lot of our relationship to the body, maybe unconsciously, is informed by a kind of a fear and a wish to control this process that it's unstoppably bound to. And so much of what we get engaged with is in the attempt to preserve and to protect this body, which is of course appropriate and necessary and important that we take care of this remarkable and precious organism, this living thing that we call body. And yet there's also a way in which we somehow kind of feel that we're not quite acknowledging or fully allowing in the truth of how it is for our body, of the journey that it has to make, that it cannot avoid making. And so what happens is we kind of react against experience, we react against life, and this pattern of fear, it's very deeply rooted, it's very wired in, it seems, to our biology. The processes that we understand from psychology of fight and flight, you're probably familiar with those phrases, as responses to danger, to threat. And how in that, there's a very kind of this, again, this attempt to preserve ourselves, and yet the reality is that ultimately we can't preserve this body. We certainly can't prevent it from entering into the journey that it's already entered, which involves aging, sickness or decay, and ultimately ends in death. And there's a way in which we kind of, it's almost like the fight we can experience or become aware of that we carry in our bodies, in our hearts, in our minds. It's like we're fighting against the way things are. We somehow just don't want it to be like this. Because, you know, really if we had a choice, wouldn't we choose to say, well, actually, you know, I'd kind of rather it didn't age too much, or maybe not even at all, you know. It depends where we've got to. At a certain point, we think, well, it might as well keep going because, you know, there's no point stopping here. But the sense of, you know, sickness and decay, it's like, oh, do I really? Does my life really have to have that? Surely if I eat the right food and do the right things and exercise and meditate and do yoga, but even with all of that, it seems to happen in one way or another. Now we kind of have this sense of almost being in battle with life, that we can start to notice in how we're relating to things. This kind of sense of pressure we're placing upon others, upon situations, upon our own experience, upon ourselves. A kind of a pressure, like we're in battle here. And there's a rather, I find, remarkable and revealing story that a friend gave me some years ago that was actually a transcript of a conversation between a radio conversation between a US naval ship with the Canadian authorities. And it took place off the coast of Newfoundland in October 1995. So it was a little while ago now. And the radio conversation was released by the Chief of Naval Operations on the 10th of October 1995. And it begins with a communication from the American ship. It says, "Please divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision." Sounds reasonable. "The Canadians respond, recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision." The Americans respond, "This is the captain of a US Navy ship. I say again, divert your course." And the Canadians, "No. I say again, you divert your course." And the Americans, "This is in capital letters, so it's, I guess, the equivalent of shouting in that form of communication. It says, this is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the United States Atlantic Fleet. We are accompanied by three destroyers, three cruisers, and numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north, that's 15 degrees north, or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of the ship." The Canadians, "This is a lighthouse." "Your call." Now, I don't know if it happened exactly like that. It certainly was presented to me as if it was so. And it's kind of amusing, isn't it? We kind of enjoy and can have a, and I too, of course, enjoy the sense of that moment of discovery when you realise that, oh, here's the ship telling something to get out of its way, and if it doesn't, we're gonna sort it out. You know, you can kind of feel that sort of getting ready to do battle. It's a battleship or aircraft carrier. And then you suddenly realise, oh my gosh, you know, if a collision is to be avoided, there's only one option here. And it isn't the lighthouse moving. Sometimes the experience in our lives is a little bit like that kind of collision coming or even happening, and us thinking, but why didn't it get out of my way? Why didn't life adjust around what I'd wish for or want it to be? It's really understandable, and yet when we look more carefully, or very human we could say, when we look more carefully at our life, as we're invited to do here, it becomes clear we can't avoid that dimension of life that's difficult and challenging. And this is something that the Buddha spoke of again and again, that we come back to in these teachings and practices again and again. We need to understand what's going on here. This movement of fear or anger that might be trying to push away something aggressively or withdraw for something that we might feel afraid of, that we notice as a form of tension or contraction or solidification in our bodies, in our experience, it comes from something deeper that actually has a wholesome quality to it, which is the need and the importance to discern and protect against harm so far as we can. And it comes out of a caring for for our well-being or the well-being of another. We only feel fear or anger or aggression in situations where something we care about is threatened or subject to harm. So it's important, again, that we don't judge those patterns and tendencies, but we see how they're not actually useful, they're not skillful, they don't effectively discharge what we're trying to get them to do, i.e. they don't actually protect us. And so being able to see what happens when we encounter the experience of threat, of danger, or of something difficult or painful, the way in which we very quickly move from the experience we're having to what we think is going to happen next. We move out of where we are. And, you know, we've talked about this, you know, the pain in my knee, and it's just a bit sore. And then we think, well, what if it goes on for the whole sitting? You know, I can't stand it. And what if it goes on all week? And suddenly we have some image of the ambulance arriving here at the Friendship Inn, and we're being taken off in a stretcher to the hospital, and, you know, it's going to be an amputation above the knee. You know, and the mind just goes there in a moment. It's so quick. This terrifying, horrible... So, and we're gripped with this fear and this pain and the suffering. But it's not really so much to do with the sensation that's arising. That might be sharp. That might be tender. That might at some point need us to adjust our posture to take care of it. It's not really about that. It's about this attempt to somehow avoid the fact that in our life, it's sometimes painful. It's sometimes uncomfortable. I remember once when I was travelling in Asia and I got ill and I was carried like a sack of potatoes to a hospital. And I remember just there was nothing in my system. I couldn't speak. There was not enough energy. I have no idea what had happened to me. I'd gone to bed feeling ill and I'd woken up unable to move. And so eventually I got someone from the hotel to carry me and take me. And they started doing some tests and things. And there was this moment where the doctor came in and he said, we think you probably have hepatitis and you might have malaria as well. And he looked very serious. And in that, and you might have malaria as well, I was just convinced, this thought came, I'm going to die. That's it. Just absolute certainty, my whole body just shock, fear, terror. Obviously I didn't, fortunately. It turned out I didn't have malaria, it was just hepatitis. And 3 weeks in hospital I was a lot better. But that sense of how much the fear impacts us, how much we're carried and driven by it, and you know, we can spend so much of our life trying to avoid things we fear, when in fact, what we're trying to do is avoid the experience of fear itself. Because fear is really unpleasant. It's really painful. It's really uncomfortable to experience. Fear of things we don't like. In fact, Mark Twain once said, almost all of the worst experiences of my life never actually happened. But it's so, you know, the things we're scared of, it's the being scared or terrified of it. That is so painful. That is the worst. It's worse than the actual difficult thing. One of the remarkable things is when something that we are scared of, that may really, truly be genuinely difficult, painful, and really hard to bear, when it happens, we can start to deal with it. Even if we wished with all our heart it wouldn't, when it happens, we can actually deal with it. When it hasn't happened, we can't deal with it. And we become lost in the fear of it if we don't recognize what's happening. And so with fear, what's really important is to be able to see that it's always happening here and now. The story goes into the future, moves at remarkable speed. At remarkable speed. You know, Olympic athletes have nothing on the speed with which the mind moves into the future. And in that, if we don't see that that's what's happening, we lose contact with the experience that's happening in the body. And the thinking and the agitation that comes out of it is somehow trying to find a way to not have to experience what's happening right here. If we can come back into our body and say, oh, okay, I'm here, and this fear, or there's distress, or there's just the sense of, I don't want this difficult experience, whatever that might be. Oh, okay, can I just feel that habitual tightening, contraction? Notice how painful that is, but that in the noticing of it, in the being aware of it, and conscious and present with it, it starts to soften, it starts to open, it starts to release. And in that opening, we can start to find a sensitivity again. The sensitivity we really need to be able to take care of ourselves. When we're in the stories of the future, when we're lost in the fear, we lose contact with our sensitivity to what's actually happening that tells us what we need to know. And I had a very interesting experience of this just recently. I was teaching a retreat in Sweden in May. And after a few days, someone reported that there was an adder down by the lake. Well, it looks like a lake. It's actually the sea, I think, sort of on the edge of the archipelago there. And by the water, shall we say. And I was really interested. We don't have any snakes in New Zealand. I've hardly ever seen snakes in my life. But it's an adder. It's a poisonous snake. So you don't want to get too close to this thing. But I was really interested to go and see it. And yet I was aware of this fear here. Okay, so what would it be to hopefully not be foolish and do something silly and get bitten, because then it'll be really embarrassing. But just to go and see, because I was fascinated at the thought of the possibility of seeing this creature. And what I noticed was, in actually being very I was really, without thinking, I'll be really mindful when I walk down here. I didn't have to make an intention, you know. When we're aware of danger, but we're actually present with that experience, rather than, oh my God, what if it happens? When we're actually in ourselves, there's a caution that actually makes us really sensitive. So I remember taking every step really mindfully. There was no likelihood of getting distracted and thinking, oh, what's for lunch, you know? Or, gosh, walking is really boring, you know? It was like, oh, I really want to check where I put my foot and what's going on around me. Because right here, I might see something that could be really amazing, like a creature that's really, to me, rare and fascinating. And I could possibly do something where I get hurt. I didn't see the snake, I didn't get bitten. But it was very interesting nonetheless just to see, oh, okay, what happens when there might be danger, but we're staying very present to see, is the danger for real right here and right now? Because this body, it is of the nature of things. It's not in our control. It can experience pleasure and pain, as we've talked about. But there's often a way that the mind, the intellect, kind of distrusts the body. Because it's not in control, because it's not predictable, because we don't know how it's going to feel like in the next moment. There can often be a tendency, therefore, and part of the reason why what we're doing is challenging, not easy for us, is that there's kind of a withdrawing of attention, a withdrawing of presence from the body, and a kind of a focusing more in the mind. We become these little sort of, one of my teachers, he talks about, it's like we're like a little head on a skateboard. You know, no body, just this head moving around with the attention all up here, with the eyes and the ears and the nose and thinking, and the mouth and the tongue and that. But the rest of it we're easily absent from. And so, when the body's experiencing fear, or when it's in the grip of craving, these two strong tendencies and patterns that Leela spoke about this morning, the wish to avoid or escape from something that might be painful, or the wish to get hold of or keep hold of something that might be pleasurable, these experiences are in themselves very painful. And when we're engaged with trying to get rid of what we're afraid of, or get hold of what we think we want in a kind of a sort of sensory, superficial stimulation, entertainment kind of wanting, often what it is that we're looking for is to come to the end of the experience of the fear, or to come to the end of the experience of the wanting, because those experiences are in themselves painful, because they're tight, they're contracted, and they have in them a sense of disconnection. Inherently, when we're lost in them, we're disconnected from our experience. So we learn to notice them, to feel into them, to become sensitive to what's actually happening in our body. And as we become more open, more connected, more sensitive, when we're not so frequently or ongoingly in the unconscious grip of fear and of craving, the body naturally begins to soften, begins to open, becomes inviting and again pleasurable to inhabit. And there's an incredible healing that takes place for us when we start to know our body as a place where we can be at rest, as a place where we can actually be nourished and even uplifted in just its simple aliveness, not needing to look for entertainment or excitement, not needing the experience to always be according to our preference and desire, but the very quality of inhabiting it with awareness, with mindfulness, with presence, has a brightening quality, has a uplifting quality for our heart. And there might be moments already in the retreat, amidst the drowsiness and the agitation, the restlessness and the confusion, that yes, may seem to be quite a large proportion of what happens. But within those, there's probably been moments also where we just landed and felt our foot settle into the soft, cool grass. Or just there was a moment when the breath, as it came in, we just felt the chest inflate. Just natural expression of in-breath, and we're just there for it. Doesn't matter how many breaths we can make it in this moment, or how much we were distracted in the previous moment, but just here, we feel, there's something that happens for us. When we're just simply in touch with the body, it starts to invite us to live more and more fully right here. This is the invitation of our body, to live more and more fully right here. And with that, when we encounter pain, to notice the reflex response of not wanting it, of aversion, of wishing to get rid of it, seeing, can I soften? Can I breathe with this experience? Can I make space for it? Actually feeling the sensations rather than the concept, the label, the idea, pain, I don't like it, but what does it feel like? Can I actually be with this? See, is it okay? Give it space. Give it space. Sometimes what tends to happen when we feel something painful, we contract around it. It's like something is already squeezed tight and we squeeze it to try and make that feeling of tightness go away. Can you see how that's not going to work? We really squeeze it hard to see if we can make it go away. Now sometimes we squeeze it so hard it gets numb. And then it seems as if it goes away, but it doesn't. Because actually that place of numbness or loss of contact becomes an expression of the deeper pain of losing contact with our hearts and our lives. That actually is what calls us to seek and to explore and to wish to understand what is possible for us, for our hearts, our minds, our bodies, to be in contact with the fullness of life, this life, our life. And so we learn to just feel into, to explore, to see what's possible. And one thing that, just as a kind of general guideline, we could say is that if you can relax with and around the pain, then it's probably okay to stay with it for a little while. If you find you just can't, but you're just tensing and tightening and gritting your teeth, then that's probably not useful at that point. that all we may be cultivating there is kind of willpower and some kind of belief that we can dominate our bodily experience by force and effort, which is not so. It's not so. So seeing if we can soften, relax, and if there's some way that adjusting your posture is possible for you in a way that brings relief, it's okay to do that. But understanding when we do that, and it's okay to do that, as I said, that there may come a time when we encounter pain, discomfort, and distress in our body that we can't adjust our way out of. Perhaps we've already been there in our lives. When actually we realize, oh, this, I can't just move it to make it feel better. This is how it is now. It hurts when I do this. Or it hurts when I do that. And our bodies tend to go in that direction. We can't avoid pain in life, much as we might wish to or believe that we should be able to. We can't. So learning to bring kind attention to it, to be interested in it, because in fact it's really important that we do this. I was shocked at one point in my travels in Asia, where I spent a little time working in a street clinic in Calcutta with Western volunteer medical staff who were offering care to the poor and struggling people who lived on the streets in that city, Calcutta. And I have no medical training myself as such, beyond sort of some basic first aid stuff. So I was just there as a kind of an unskilled assistant. But one of the things I learnt, still I find shocking to reflect upon, we had amongst other people there lepers who were being treated. And I always had this association and idea that leprosy was this horrible disease that makes bits of your body fall off and it's just, oh, yuck. You know, and it's not true. I understood there from one of the medical people, because that we were treating these people with leprosy, that leprosy doesn't do that. Leprosy kills the nerve tissue, so you can't feel pain. And in people who are poor, with no real understanding of how disease works or principles of cleanliness, they cut themselves. It doesn't hurt, so it doesn't matter. It gets dirty, it gets infected. It begins to decay or rot. They don't feel it. It's not a problem. It's not taken care of. Or they burn themselves on something hot. They don't feel it. The tissue is destroyed. And that's how people in that situation lose fingers and lips and noses and parts of their body in situations where it's easy to catch an infection and they don't even know it's happening because there's no pain. And the thing that was shocking, apart from that, was the thing that which would most improve the quality of life and well-being of a leper was the ability to feel pain. And it really gives a different perspective on one's wish to avoid it. It really does. I recently, and rather frustratingly for me, sprained my ankle just a week ago now. Just a couple of days before I was coming. And there's that sense of, oh, no, damn, why did that have to happen? For all sorts of reasons, there are better times I could think to sprain an ankle than just now. And now is a bad time. I have to come to Finland and in a month or so I'm going to be trekking and all these things. And yet, you know, it's really important that it hurt when I did it, so that I knew that I hurt my ankle and I stopped. And I took care of it, because if I didn't feel any pain, I'd have happily continued doing what I was doing. When we put it in that context, we see, oh, the function of pain is really clear. What it says is, pay attention here. And it says it really effectively. Pay attention here. That's what we need to do. Pay attention here and see, is there some danger? There isn't always danger. But if there is, we need to attend to it. But pay attention here. Not pay attention to somewhere else. Because here is where the pain is. Here is where the experience can actually be attended to. And in this there's a a capacity, we have a potential for learning, for understanding that's really important. And the prophet Khalil Gibran speaks of this. He says, your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Just as the stone of a fruit must break so that its heart may stand in the sun, so too must you know pain. And it's not easy for us to really, I think, take this on. The sense of, oh, yeah, this is actually part of life. It has its place. It has its place. Because in trying to avoid pain, in not paying attention to where there may be that which we find difficult, challenging, or scary in our experience, in withdrawing from that, there's a hardening, a desensitizing, a disconnection. A disconnection from the vitality, the aliveness, and the beauty and fullness of our lives. And this disconnection is actually the deeper suffering. This is actually the deeper pain that, again, calls us or speaks to us or draws us to be willing to have the courage and the nobility to engage in practice such as this and other practices too, that aren't easy, that aren't always comfortable, but that are nonetheless perhaps the most important thing we might engage in our lives. And this process opens us up, whether we wish it to or like it or not. This process opens us up. It strips quite naturally and organically, but unstoppably, starts to soften, to melt, and ultimately to strip the armoring from our hearts, from our bodies, from our minds as well. The armoring that's expressed in the form of that, no, I do not wish, I will not include, I'm not going to allow this dimension of experience to be felt. And so, it's very interesting, this process. Not always easy for us, but so important. And just another story I'd like to share that for me impressed very viscerally the significance of this. When I was teaching in America some years ago at the Insight Meditation Society, which is a sort of, sometimes we, I guess, call sometimes the mothership of the tradition. And it was the first center in the West where retreats like this were taught on a regular basis. And the founding teachers there were some of the senior teachers of this Insight Meditation tradition, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and Jack Kornfield. And it's a wonderful place. I feel very privileged when I travel there and get to teach there. And on this occasion, I was going for a walk in the woods down to the pond, a small lake. And as I was walking through the woods, suddenly, about two or three paces in front of me, I saw the snake, and it was like, the body of the snake was like this, across the path. And I've already told you, we don't have snakes where I come from. It was like this moment, I just stopped dead still, like, snake! You know, and I could see part of me was going to go, run! But part of me was going, snake! And so I just, between the two of them, stopped. And I stood there, and I looked. And it wasn't moving. So I got a bit of courage up, and I went a little closer. It wasn't moving, I went a little closer, and closer. And then I realized it's not a snake. It's a snake skin left on the path, just like a snake, but with no snake inside. And in the Dharma teachings, there's all these stories about getting confused between a rope and a snake, and how it's really embarrassing if you see a rope and think it's a snake and run away scared, and this happens to us. And it's more than embarrassing if you see a snake and think it's a rope and grab it, because then you get hurt. So you really want to pay attention to these things in the Dharma teachings. It's really clear. And there was I paying attention to the snake. And it's not a snake, it's a snake skin. And I started thinking, so what happens here? It's obvious, we all know this, I guess, if we think about it. Snakes have to shed their skin every year. that creature has to get out of its skin. Why does it do that? Because its skin is its protection. It keeps it safe. It's its armor. But by virtue of being hard and shiny and strong, it's not very stretchy. So the snake inside can't grow. And in fact, if it doesn't shed its skin, it will die. And as it sheds its skin, it can't go very fast, it can't travel very easily, and I'm guessing that when it comes out of there, it's going to be kind of a bit sort of pink and, well, I don't know, pink, maybe white, I don't know what colour, but it's kind of juicy, you know, like soft, because if it came out with another shell already around it just as hard, it wouldn't be any bigger, could it? It couldn't be any larger. So it's got to come out of there soft and vulnerable, like it doesn't want to meet an eagle when it's doing that. It really doesn't. And I kind of thought, oh yeah, that's kind of like what this process is like. We start to see, oh, this, the kind of the contractions of self, of who we think we are, and our resistance to the difficult things of life. It's a bit like that shell that, although it's protective in one level, it's limiting, it's imprisoning, and we actually need to find our way out of it. And part of what happens here in this journey is that it starts to soften, it starts to open. And sometimes we think, I'm not sure if this is a good idea. I'm really not convinced. And of course, it's not that we have to force it or rush it, allowing it to happen in its own organic time. So it requires some patience equally as courage. And yet this is part of the journey. This is part of what happens. And in that, we really need to learn what it means to befriend those experiences we find difficult or scary. To genuinely befriend our lives, which includes such experiences for all of us. Different. Each of us have our own particular versions of it. But all of us, we share in this. It's something that we share not just with each other but with all of life. This vulnerability of having a body subject to aging, to decay, to injury, to illness. And so I'd just like to read a story that teacher I mentioned before. Can't quite remember now what I mentioned him about, saying about. Anyway, his name is Ajahn Sucitto. He's an English Buddhist monk who lives in a monastery in England. And I first met him in 1991. He was on a pilgrimage through India and turned up at this retreat where I was practicing in a temple in the Buddh Gaya. And he gave a wonderful Dharma talk that I transcribed the story from. I was so touched by it. So I'd like to read it to you. And it's him speaking, not me, although it's in the first person. And he said, many years ago I had this particular pain in my right shoulder. I would sit, pain, I would think, be with the pain, that will do it. Here am I, being with the pain. Being with the pain. It's not working, you know. Maybe I need to do some yoga. That's got it. Oh no, cushions. One cushion, two cushions, three, four. Maybe angle to the left or to the right. It's not working. Doctor, can you help me? Or chiropractor, osteopath. 5 years I had this pain. I had an extremely active and ingenious mind at trying to find every possible way to wriggle out of the fact that pain hurts and I don't like it. A very obvious truth. Yet I hadn't actually come to that. Accepted what one glosses over in a few words. I don't like pain. Instead, I had acted on I don't like pain. I hadn't actually examined the experience of not liking pain. I tried to think, well, you should like pain. Pain is good for you. Or, pain is bad, make it go away. But I hadn't actually looked into I do not like. So, one day sitting in meditation, I thought, this is it, the showdown. I'm going to sit here for 5 hours, not moving, and I'm going to get over this thing. So pain, pain, wriggle. Why did I say that? Why 5 hours? After all, this is the middle way, you know, moderation and all that. Hours go by, 2 hours, 3 hours, 3 hours and 1 minute. After about 4 hours, I was so sick of this pain. My mind had been through all the various circuits, it'd be nice to it, be friendly with it, kill it, and came back to, oh God, this pain. And finally the mind just rested. It got tired out, I guess. Eventually, ignorance does get tired out after a while and has to take a break from being ignorant, and instead of ignoring it and repressing it, actually began to open to it. Without that, let's open to it and make it go away, or let's open to it and that will make me go into some kind of cosmic space, but just, oh, all right. And then I began to see the sensation throbbing away. It began to appear in my mind as a kind of glowing light, throbbing, tearing, a tearing experience. And then, because of this choiceless attention to it, I began to notice, well, there's that. And then there's this terrible kind of no, no, no feeling going on, resistance. And with that, a whole lot of bitterness towards the body, bitterness towards pain. Oh, pain, I don't like it, it shouldn't happen to me. What did I do? I'm sitting here trying to be peaceful. Pain, go away. And this kind of moaning mind. And as I contemplated my relationship to the sensation, it became clear to me that there was nothing I could do with the sensation. But I could stop beating it with my mind. I began to have this experience of deep regret for all the beatings and the kickings that this mind had imposed upon life, upon this body, upon itself, upon its own thoughts, telling it to shut up, telling it to be this way or that way. And I felt like this whole system was like some mangy dog that had never really been loved, that had just been told what to do and beaten. And in fact, this vision arose in my mind of this dog, a kind of mangy, hungry wolf, looking at me saying, how long are you going to keep beating me for? And I felt the sense of deep regret that there should be so much intolerance and hardness towards life. In my mind's eye, something in me reached out to this creature, started to pat it, and to say, please forgive me. Then the creature turned into a cartoon dog. I always think of Scooby-Doo. And we started dancing, me and the pain, me and the dog, dancing. And then the whole thing just exploded very gently. And the pain disappeared. It seemed to say, thank you. Finally, I've been knocking on your door for 5 years. Thank you for opening. Thank you for recognizing that the problem was, I do not like, I will not accept, I will not open to you. And once you open, the lesson has been learned. The business is finished. It's a remarkable story, and I find it just a touching experience that speaks to what goes on, I think, for so many of us, so much of the time, with difficult things. And it's really important when we hear that story, we don't listen to it and think, ah, so that's how you do it. Okay? As Ram Dass once said, he said, you know, you can't be with something in order to make it go away, because it knows. And it does, it knows, it's the same system that's wanting it to go away as the thing that we want to go away. So acceptance and opening is when we're willing for it to be here and willing for it to change. And we understand that that's not in our control, that that's not up to us. And as we soften, as we open, as we allow the life of our body to be felt more deeply, more fully, in all its expressions, in all the ways it comes, it can start to reveal its nature to us. We start to see that it's alive, that it's changing, that it's moving and flowing, and that we tend to relate to this body and the way we relate to this life. We tend to think it belongs to me. And if it belongs to me, it should do what I tell it to, or it should be as I wish it to be. And yet if we look at this body and think it's ours, we're missing something. We're missing something because actually, you know, we're one of the inhabitants, that's for sure. But you know, there's quite a few others. There's quite a few organisms living in this organic tissue. And in fact, within the human frame, what we call me or you, there are 10 bacteria or other things for every cell of human tissue. It's 10 to 1 in this body between what we could call them and what we might call me. So, you know, we could say it's a co-housing project. It's absolutely not mine in that sense. It's theirs too. And if it was a democracy, we'd be outvoted really seriously. You know, we wouldn't get to choose what happens here. Does that sound like your experience ever? Oh, I didn't get to choose what happened here. Sometimes we do. That's also democracy. We get a vote. Some of the things we can make happen, wave our arms about, we can do it. But some of the things going on in here, that's just going on. That's just happening. And there's a whole lot of creatures taking part in that. So we might start to feel more kind of kindly then towards the other creatures, the ones that inhabit between my toes that I spent years of my life trying to get rid of. You know, a member of the mushroom family. And they live there. And I've said in the end, well, okay, you can have that, but I'll keep the rest. You know, because they're not going away, and I know that in the end they're going to have the rest when I'm gone. They're not going to hold back at that point. But why be embarrassed about that? Why be angry about that? Of course, that's what's going on. And in fact, aren't we so fortunate to have this body at all? Aren't we so remarkably fortunate that we have the use of this body with all these other beings? And might we not then relate to it differently? Might we not feel that it's okay to share it? That it's not just for me, this body, not just for me, this life. And in that, of course, doing what we can to take care of it. Really, it's important we take care of it. Yeah. And I'm just noticing I need to take care of my ankle right now, so I'm going to move it. Which, in another situation, I might not have. I don't often do this. But Leela and I noticed that having thought it wasn't swelling up, it started swelling up the last day again. So I'm going to stick it out and point it at you, which in traditional Buddhist circles would be very disrespectful. Please don't take this personally. This body that we have to practice in, to practice with, to live our lives in and with. It's a remarkable thing. A remarkable thing. You know, in some ways it's just a hollow tube. It's the long pipe from the top to the bottom. Not that different than a worm or a snake. You know, it's just a tube. You put in food at one end and some of it gets turned into the tube and some of it comes out the other end. Most of that we're not really in charge of. Got these various appendages for getting food and trying to avoid becoming something else's food. Spit on top for checking to see what looks like food and what looks like it might want to make us into food. In one sense, there's just a very simple biological reality happening here. There's a few extra tubes for making more tubes, you know. But that's basically the way it is for all beings. All creatures have some version of this. And yet, within this, this form that comes together for a while, we see the food that was outside it on a plate that looked, yum, really nice, delicious even, the wonderful food that's presented and offered to us, cooked for us here. So much care and love. And it looks beautiful in the plate, and maybe we're even thinking of it, looking forward to it. And then, of course, you know, it gets into our body and if it should come back from when it got in there, we don't want to see it. We don't want to know about it. We want it just to be tidy and, you know, and then at the other end, you know we keep that pretty private and, you know, understandably, it's appropriate. But at another level, oh, look, this body is made up of everything around us. This breath is shared. It's not just oxygen that has been breathed out by the leaves around us. It's equally been breathed out by our neighbours. You know, it's not sometimes quite as a sort of a sort of a sort of an uplifting thought. Oh, how nice, I'm breathing in the trees. No, no, we're breathing in our neighbour's breath. We've all been doing it all day, certainly in the room. We are much closer to each other than we realise. And in this body, as we start to see how it does it by itself, it breathes, it feels, it moves, it digests food, it maintains temperature, it circulates. For so long as it does it, it does it. And we don't have to. We can start to relax around all of that. It's like, okay, yeah, life breathes. Life breathes, and we're here in that. And in the opening to this, we see, just as the Buddha said, that within this fathom-long body, or this not quite 2 meters long body, there isn't a single measurement and metric that's close enough to 6 feet, which is a fathom, which is not even exactly average height, but something closer. But within this human body, the whole of the Dharma is revealed. The truth of dukkha, of suffering, and its cause. And equally the truth of the end of suffering, of freedom, and the path thereto. All of this can be known through this body. As we learn what it means to inhabit this body with sensitivity, with kindness, with respect, with an open heart, this body speaks to us of the life we are part of, and it speaks to us of the vastness, the connectedness, and the mystery of just being here at all. Just being here at all. And so we're invited again and again to come in to this body, to wake up in this body. There isn't somewhere else. Just here. So let's sit quietly for a few moments together. So may we all in our practice here together and in our lives, may we come to deeply befriend and cherish these human bodies just as they are. And may we come to know through them and through our lives the Dharma of kindness and freedom. For our own welfare and for the welfare of all beings.